Good afternoon and welcome to the Times and Sunday Times Literary Festival. And welcome to Russia, China and the new Cold War. Joining me today are Gilbert Achecard, who is the author of the book The New Cold War. Gilbert is a professor of international relations at SOAS, University of London. To his left, or to your right, you will see Robin Niblett, who's a distinguished fellow and former director of Chatham House. My name's Peter Conradi. I'm the Europe editor of the Sunday Times. An apology to those of you that all came to see Isabel Hilton, who unfortunately couldn't be with us today, or those of you that came to see Ben Hoyle, the foreign editor of the Sunday Times, who also couldn't be here, so I'm stepping in for him. That being said, I think we've got plenty to discuss. And we're going to talk, we've got, I think, 54 minutes and 24 seconds, apparently. We're going to talk for about 40 or so minutes of those, probably. Then there will be plenty of time for questions. These days we don't do anything as boring as have someone with a microphone coming around. It's all digitalized, as you will see above here. I think it should be self-explanatory, so you go to slido.com, enter the code, type in your question and name. Can be anonymous if you like. If you're sort of asking a question on any behalf of any institutions in the neighborhood, obviously you can do so anonymously. And yeah, we'll take it from there. So I think maybe it makes sense to start with Gilbert. Said he's got a new book out, The New Cold War. Why now? Why is it new?
Right. Thank you very much, Peter, and thanks to the organizers for inviting me. Why now? Well, I think why now is the easiest to answer. I mean, the world is in such a tense situation, and I should say this week even more that there's obviously something which is not at all what was expected in the 90s. If you go back to the 90s, if you remember, and you remember that well, you are well placed to see that period. You had the first war on Iraq, but that was made led by the United States, while announcing a new world order, which would be based on international law and the rest. And that was a war that was green-lighted by the United Nations Security Council, with China abstaining, Moscow voting in favor of Gorbachev, Moscow. So that was really green-lighted by the UN. And then you had the Oslo Accord. Just think of that. You know, famous Arafat, Rabin and Paris, with Clinton behind this moment of hope. I'm saying that because everyone is very much conscious of the terrible drama that is going on in Palestine, this absolutely tragic situation there. So you had the end of apartheid. So, I mean, that was a period where people had so many hopes or were optimistic about the future. There was a lot of talk about the peace dividend, the fact that, you know, all these savings in military expenditure will be used for social purposes. Today we would say for environmental purposes, that the conscience wasn't there enough in the 90s. So how did we get from that into what you have today in today's world?
And we should also mention the end of history. That was the great buzz phrase.
Well,
no discussion is complete without the age.
Exactly. That was the let's say the paroxystic expression of this optimism that
yes.
You had. Almost naive. I mean, or really, in fact, naive. That yes, with democracy, liberal democracy, and the free market was the end of history. Okay. Well, you had very quickly after that another thesis, which was the Clash of Civilizations by Huntington, which was a counter thesis. So that's where you had a realist explaining, no, you will have other types of conflicts. Anyway, the key point is during the 90s, I mean, the 90s were really a crucial, absolutely crucial historical period, like every period where you have a winner in a major war, defining the conditions for the post-war world. And that winner was the United States, obviously, facing the Soviet Union, which crumbled. By the end of 91, there was no longer a Soviet Union. And you had a very tense debate in the Clinton administration, the first Clinton administration, on how to deal with Russia, right? And what to do with NATO. And people today ignore, or don't know about the fact that even at the top of the U.S. Power elite, in Washington, you had a debate even at the top in the cabinet, in the administration. And the Secretary for Defense of the time advocated an integration of Russia into the world system, a massive economic help like the Marshall Plan for Western Europe after 45. So he advocated dealing with Russia as Germany was treated, West Germany, of course, after 45. And against that, you had those who based everything on the assumption that Russia is a potential enemy and therefore maintaining a high level of military expenditure. So in that regard, there is a continuity in military expenditure between the Cold War and the post-Cold War for the United States. And then the expansion of NATO and the transformation of NATO into a security organization, the first NATO wars ever were waged after the end of the Soviet Union, whereas NATO was founded as a bulwark against the Soviet Union. So you see the paradox here. And then the expansion of NATO towards Russian borders. And all that, as someone whom I quote in the book in 94, was an advisor to Gorbachev, former advisor to Gorbachev, predicted very clearly, telling the West, it was in foreign policy, so it was addressed to the West, 1994, what you're doing economically and politically with Russia will lead to revanchism and authoritarian nationalist power. And that's what you had with, the prediction was completely verified. And that's the point, that we have to understand that some choices, some options taken in the 90s opened the way to a new Cold War, with the specificity this time that whereas China, during the last years of the Cold War, the first Cold War, let's put it that way, was actually in some kind of alliance with the United States against the Soviet Union, to the point that even that people now forget or don't know about it. In the late 70s, the United States even gave weapons to China, right? Yeah. Clinton managed to antagonize the Chinese. Before him, Bush Sr. had breached the agreements with the Chinese into selling weapons, advanced weapons to Taiwan. That was a breach of commitment from the United States. And so you had this issue of Taiwan becoming a very hot issue. And that's how this new Cold War took this shape that it has, where you have the United States and the Western alliance on the one hand, and then you have China and Russia in some kind of alliance of convenience, because there's no love between the two countries. Anyone knowing their history would know that there's no love between them, but basically facing what they see as a bullying a superpower, which is the United States.
So, your exposition, it almost seems like the current mess that we're in seems to be America's fault, primarily. Robin, do you see it like that? Maybe I've created a straw man for you to knock down, but...
No, but it's good to start with the big thesis, and then we can dig into it. Do I see it as America making a mistake? No. I was in Washington through some of this period we were discussing earlier, in that variant period of 88 to 1992, right at the end of the last Cold War, and watching that moment happen. And yes, it was unexpected, and I think America was not prepared for the Soviet Union's collapse, and that in itself meant they didn't have a plan, they hadn't worked it out. It became a bit of a competition between the Jeffrey Sachs people, and yes, we can put money in, we'll just turn it into a wonderful democracy, and other, let's call them more realist people, who felt that actually Russia could end up being on a different path and that we need to hedge against the future. I think the bit that's missing from some of this, and then I was back in Washington again between 97 and 2007, watching the kind of later period of American adaptation, you know, after the 9/11 attacks and so on. So there've been these different phases in America, but I think what we must not forget was the demand factor. If you were a leader in Central Eastern Europe, and the Soviets had pulled out, who'd kept you and your country in a pretty backward state, economically, certainly compared to where we were before, no personal freedoms. And you think, in a way, they'd pulled out because they'd sort of collapsed to a certain extent. Those leaders, I remember being in Washington at the time, were demanding to be in NATO. So it wasn't America saying, we must expand NATO. Now, there were some who were in favor of it. But there was a demand as well as a push. There was definitely a debate in Washington. Some people, as you said, George Kennan even saying this is a bad idea. Ken Waltz, there's a whole bunch of people who said it was a bad idea. But there was a lot of demand. And if what had won at the end of the First World War was democracy, that was the view. And these countries that had been stuck, as they saw it, on the wrong side of the curtain, they were desperate to be inside the other club. And they said, we know Russia. They'll be back, kind of view. And you've got a lot of former Europeans, East Europeans, Central Europeans, beginning Brzezinski, even Kissinger himself, who all experienced European history, that myself. That realist view was, if these countries want to come in, let them in. We would rather bake in long-term stability, because we know NATO provides stability on one side. Let's have a few more countries, better have clarity. Zbigniew Brzezinski had his famous line, if Ukraine is left as a vacuum, the vacuum will get filled. And so many people believed, don't let the vacuum be filled. So I think that's an important element here. The other part of it is, could Russia have been different? Now, you know, who knows, yeah? But there's been some very interesting books written by academics who've studied a lot of the days when you could get inside Russian documents. You can't anymore. But just showing the extent to which people like Vladimir Putin and the KGB were not going to let the collapse of the Soviet Union stand, or at least not let the collapse of Russia stand, and had always had a view that at some point they would want to, you know, reestablish some type of control, make sure, as historically, that their buffer states were buffer states, and that they have a right to have a sphere of influence, and other countries are meant to be a sphere of influence to great powers. That's the way you think, you know. But if you are in our part of the world, you tend to say to countries that don't want to be in somebody else's sphere of influence and look to you for your help, yeah, okay, if we can help, we will. So I think when we look at China, and I'll just bring China in for a second, you know, we can say we lost Russia because we didn't help them enough. We didn't integrate them enough. But China was integrated and helped a lot, in fact, massively integrated into the West economically over the years. But China has ended up still being China. And so the question is, which way might it have gone? I actually have this feeling of almost inevitability about where we are, principally because I think we've got two completely different systems of government, two different views of the world that are incompatible.
Or maybe
they are going to bump up to each other somewhere.
Or maybe three systems of government.
I mean, which is
talking about the Western view, the Chinese view, the Russian view, or are you saying the Chinese and the Russian view form of government are essentially the same?
I'll put this on the table and then we can disagree or agree. I will probably disagree. I'll say they're similar in one very important sense right now, that the view of the leadership in Beijing and the leadership in Moscow is that state sovereignty comes first. Citizens are there to make sure and help the states be strong. But one means the state tries to look after citizens, and some do it better than others. But ultimately, checks and balances, democracy, is dangerous. It undermines the strong state. Our view is checks and balances, okay, it's messy, it's chaotic, but that's what freedom is, and we enjoy being in it. And by the way, yeah, I'd much rather be in that world. And I understand why others would want to be in that world as well. So I think there is actually a very important difference. between the way China, the Chinese leadership and the Russian leadership view the world, which is having a strong government is the most important thing. And if you look at Xi Jinping, the party is now, what that famous line, at the center. Academia, business, northeast, west, south and center, nothing will challenge the party. And that is very similar to Putin.
Mm. So, Gilbert, I mean, do you think, was there a sort of an inevitability that as Russia recovered, it would reassert itself as China has become stronger and stronger? It asserts itself, and in a sense, it didn't really matter whatever we'd done. If you have these two counterexamples, sort of integrating China and not doing enough for Russia, if it leads to the same result, is there not a sort of an inevitability about countries which are large, which are proud, which have got these strong particular traditions, you know, that are different from Slovakia or are different from Slovenia, that, you know, they are automatically going to be big players, and it's the geography that dictates it, and it's irrelevant what we did.
Right. It's like telling you, you know, at the end of the First World War, conditions were imposed on Germany in 1919 at the Versailles Conference. It's called the Versailles Treaty. And a British man who became very well known after that attended that. His name is John Maynard Keynes. And he wrote a book right after that, called The Economic Consequences of the Peace, explained that the conditions, the political and economic conditions that you're imposing on the Germans will lead to a catastrophe and will lead to the return of revanchism and nationalism in Germany. Now, you would have had Hitler after that, and you would have told me, well, you see, I mean, the prediction that Germany was doomed to be like that has been fulfilled. But I would have told you, like Keynes would have told you, that was a self-fulfilling prophecy that you had when you made it, if you made it in 1919. You see the point. So the issue here is that, yes, I think a different Russia would have been possible, but with different conditions. The global conditions, a different treatment of Russia, not supporting someone like Yeltsin, for instance, when he attacked the parliament, not supporting the first Chechnya war waged by Yeltsin under Yeltsin, not doing all that, and also not antagonizing, not letting the military-industrial complex of Russia to come back to the fore by teasing up nationalism with this expansion of NATO. Yes, there were, what you said, Robin, is right. But, and the Germans, West Germany, Kohl, was pushing for the integration of these states in NATO. But there was something different possible. There was the possibility of revamping a pan-European institution like the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. There was the possibility of making some deals about like the 94 one about Ukraine, about the territorial integrity and sovereignty of all states, having that kind of deal with the Russian and not letting them perceive Western countries as continuing on the same path of antagonizing Russia, looking at Russia as an enemy. And those realists that you mentioned that were in favor of that were led by Brzezinski. Mm-hmm. And Brzezinski is a Russophobe, basically. I mean, for Brzezinski... Mm. And by the same Brzezinski believed that China would be the great ally of the United States, and the United States should integrate China. And you see that, according to what you said, you must believe that Brzezinski was completely wrong. So he was wrong on China. I think he was also wrong on Russia.
Robin, you look like you might not agree.
Again, I mean, I just think the parallel of 1919, absolutely the mistake of imposing harsh economic conditions, reparations, to a country that thought it had not lost. Again, Russia thought it had not lost the Cold War. It had, you know, cleverly withdrawn at a moment where it was weak, but it certainly didn't think of itself as a defeated power, just as the Germans didn't think themselves, part of them, as a defeated power in 1919. But we did not impose reparations on Russia. The parallel is not the same in my mind. Yes, we weren't nice to the Russians, you could say. Although, by the way, some were. A lot of money was put in. Maybe the ideas were naive, but those ideas were that somehow Russia would become a democratic free market economy. You can accuse the Americans of naivety because they reached out to Russia. No, nothing about reparations. No reparations. It was, we'll bring them in. We'll have privatization. We'll just give them a crash course in our system of government and everything will be lovely. Yeah, that was not a very realist approach, that's for sure. But it was not imposing reparations on them. The problem is that in a part of Russia, felt deeply humiliated by the end of the war. Vladimir Putin has communicated the best by saying it was the largest tragedy of the 20th century. It was the collapse of the Soviet Union. And ultimately did believe, and I would agree, I don't want to get the moderator in the middle of this, but I think your point, Peter, about, you know, a massive landmass that has been invaded many times thinks of its neighbors as buffers. That's what they are. But you know, I think there's a debate as to whether you let countries be buffers that don't want to be buffers. And a modern approach would say, you know, that's not necessarily your fate. I think it's interesting that, you know, my worry is that there are certain types of leadership that are more paranoid than others. Kissinger has written a very interesting chapter about, in one of his books, about Russia. But this sense of their own history means that you are always worried about interference from outside. And therefore, in the end, the idea is Ukraine had to be like Belarus. Yeah, Belarus is fine. It's led by this dictator called Lukashenko. He's in charge. Vladimir Putin had managed to set up Viktor Yanukovych, with a lot of bribery and a lot of money, to remain as the leader of Ukraine. What was it that drove the 2014 annexation of Crimea? It wasn't the enlargement of NATO. There was no talk about NATO at that point. It was the expansion of the European Union, not NATO. Viktor Yanukovych was meant to sign a deep and comprehensive free trade agreement in 2014 with the EU. But it was the EU that felt more of a threat because it would have brought transparency. It would have given opportunity to the Ukrainians to maybe have the same GDP per capita as the Poles, who'd seen their GDP per capita triple ahead of Ukraine's in the 10-year period between 2004 and 2014. That's a bigger worry. So I just think that in the end, this is not just about NATO expansion. It's about systems of government trying to create space to protect themselves. And therefore, I think this idea that we could have, should have, I just don't buy it.
I must say, I mean, I was in the happy position of actually being in Moscow at the time, of the collapse of communism in 89, 90, 91, and so on. And I mean, I must say, one didn't have the impression that one was in a country that was being oppressed by the Americans. But I think there was an awful lot of aid flowing in. There was like emergency food aid flowing in. It seemed almost absurd that there were kind of food parcels being sent to the country where, you know, people didn't quite know what to do with them often. It was a strange kind of situation. I would say perhaps the problems come from the fact that there were three things that were going on almost simultaneously. One was the end of communism, one was the end of the Cold War, and one was the collapse of the Soviet Union. These became conflated, and that people interpreted what had happened in different ways. And I think the Russians legitimately felt that they had somehow, or some Russians felt they had liberated themselves from a system and had to be rewarded for it. The Americans in particular thought that they had defeated a foe and that there was this fundamental misunderstanding, perhaps coupled with a no sharp break between the old regime and the new regime, because Boris Yeltsin, who was the leader, was himself, you know, the leader of the first Free Russia, was himself a former communist apparatchik. And that, you know, it was all these confusions that maybe led to people not quite knowing what they were dealing with and drawing their own conclusions. I mean, is that a fair representation, or am I being too kind to the Americans?
Yes, I think you are. And Robin too.
Yeah, probably me too.
Right. Well, of course there were no reparations imposed on, and why so? I mean, this is a different story. I mean, Russia, the Soviet Union had not invaded any country except, I mean, the expansion of Russian influence was in the fight against Nazism, against Nazi Germany.
Prague Spring and
well, that's
Budapest,
not something that would lead to reparations.
No.
That wasn't any kind of war. That's a repressive action by the Soviet bureaucratic state, but that's not the same. But economically, it wasn't what you were saying, lots of money. That's wrong. I mean, that wasn't at all lots of money. And even William Perry, the Secretary of Defense, explains in his book that this is nothing like the Marshall Plan that was given to Russia. But more importantly than that, after 1945, the economic system that even in the West was prevailing was Keynesian, right? Mm-hmm. Just the second time I'm mentioning Keynes today. And that was something where the state was encouraged to lead the economic transformation and the reconstruction of these countries.
But not in 1992.
Exactly.
We had Thatcherism.
Exactly. And what was fostered, people like Jeffrey Sachs that you mentioned, is linked to the shock therapy.
Exactly.
And this led to a collapse of the Russian economy, which is much bigger during the 90s than the collapse of the Soviet economy, during the Second World War. Can you imagine that? The 90s, if you have BBC iPlayer, if you're interested in that, there is a series called Trauma Zone about Russia and the 90s.
It's an excellent, six, seven episodes, isn't it?
Yes.
Very, very long.
It's absolutely excellent. Mm. It shows you the devastation of Russia in the 90s, and it even shows you the role of the West in that, by the way.
I think an interesting counterexample would be that same shock therapy was applied in Poland. I mean, Jeffrey Sachs, if I remember rightly, started out doing the same thing in Poland, yet somehow in Poland, it led to extraordinary economic success. I mean, I was in Poland a couple of weeks ago. The Polish economy, I think, is due to perhaps per capita be stronger than the British economy in 2030. So how come it worked in Poland? In a sense, aren't the Russians themselves a little bit to blame in all of this?
Well, of course.
I lived among them for a few years.
They were, but Poland has been helped at a much higher level because Germany had a direct stake in the issue of Poland. We're speaking of buffer. Well, for the Germans, Poland is one. And they have the same, I mean, it's not only the Russians who aren't, you know, concerned with buffer states and the rest. The German are too. Every country that has been in several and repeated wars in its history had this problem with securing an environment that lets it feel safe. And we can't blame any country for that, as long as it doesn't mean invading other countries. And here I would say that, of course, the 2014 was not entirely about NATO expansion. Let me say. In 2008, George W. Bush insisted to have NATO invite Georgia and Ukraine to join NATO. Two U.S. ambassadors were damnly against that and warned Bush and Condoleezza Rice, was his Secretary of State, against it. U.S. Ambassador to Moscow and U.S. Ambassador to NATO. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't have people better placed to know what they are speaking about. Saying this is going to create a disaster with the Russians. And that's what happened. 2008, just after that, Putin puts his foot, to block the door in Georgia. And then 2014, why he waits until 2014? Because until 2014, the government in Ukraine was not pro-NATO. And the public opinion of Ukraine was not for joining NATO. Mm-hmm. In 2014, you had the Maidan upheaval, the Maidan revolution, and that changed everything. And that's when Putin decided to do the same as he did in Georgia, in eastern Ukraine, and
Crimea.
Crimea is a different story. He could have just done what he did in eastern Ukraine. That would have been enough to block Ukraine's accession to NATO. Crimea was to boost his own government, his own legitimacy. because in the 2011-2013 period, Putin faced the rise of mass opposition to his rule in Russia.
Yep.
And therefore he needed something to restore his popularity or boost his popularity. And he found the Crimea issue because Crimea was a popular issue. And we have, and the truth is, it is a popular issue for the Russians. And in fact, when you see that the invasion of Crimea was actually peaceful. I mean, there was not a single shot during that. Whereas we saw how Russian troops were met in Ukraine, we can see that there is a difference between Crimea and Ukraine. There is a point for the Russian in that. Doesn't justify them invading, but there was definitely a problem with Crimea that could have been settled democratically by the right to self-determination in a democratic framework with the United Nations organizing this. That wasn't the path chosen for the reason explained, the boosting nationalism for Russia.
Although I suppose it should be pointed out that even though the population of Crimea was, you know, predominantly Russian, partly because the Russians had moved there and the Tatars had been kind of chased out. But back in 1991, when there was a referendum on breaking up the Soviet Union, on leaving, the Crimeans, along with the rest of Ukrainians, did vote for seceding, not by anything like the same margin as the rest of the Ukrainians. Yeah. But, Robin, there are lots of points to address I think.
Look, I'm just going back over history. I mean, one thing I would note is that the Ukrainians were not particularly ready to defend anything in 2014. The Ukrainian army has used the 8 years afterwards to get good at fighting, demonstrated their capacities, obviously, in February, March, and beyond 2022. So in any case, who knows quite how Crimea might have played out, but definitely, as you said, the politics there had changed quite fundamentally. I think if we stay on the Russian side of the equation at the moment, I think we may miss some of the aspects of the Cold War part of this, because I think in the end, part of what gives President Putin the strength to persist and perhaps, in his mind, succeed in the current conflict he's in right now, is the China angle. And I think
we should talk more about China, I think, now.
Yeah, it just strikes me that we're at this fascinating moment where, and maybe this is an issue that Gilbert and I would agree, I think China was definitely trying to keep out of any kind of Cold War. As I was saying at the beginning, they're hugely invested in the global economy. China is very, very different to Russia in the sense that China benefits from a stable global economy. It's invested in it. It gets money from it. It needs the imports. Russia, in a way, benefits from disorder because it's got its own resources. The price goes up. It does better. We're fine. And the irony is that by carrying out a full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 24th last year, 2022, what he's done, Putin, is kind of forced China to come off the fence. And they didn't want to, but they have been forced to come off the fence. Now, they've tried to be very careful. As I think you all know here, there was this meeting on February the 4th in Beijing when President Putin came over just before the Winter Olympics. They signed a thing called, it's been shorthanded to the No Limits Partnership Agreement, but which pointed out all of the areas in which Russia and China would work closely for the long term. Since the invasion, of course, we found out there are limits to the partnership because, the Chinese are not providing weapons. They're not breaking the SWIFT financial sanctions imposed on Russian banks and the Russian Central Bank. But what they have done is two incredibly important things. Number one, they've had to make a calculus. And I would say that in Beijing, the calculus is we don't need Putin to win, but we cannot afford to have him lose. If he loses, we potentially then have chaos on our border behind us at the very moment when we're very worried about America on the other side, out in the Pacific and globally. So we need to make sure that Russia at least doesn't lose. What they've also concluded is that this is a real opportunity right now for China, as Xi Jinping said to Vladimir Putin on his last visit there in March this year, "The world is changing as it's never changed before. You, my dear friend, and I are leading the change." And that change is, this is a moment potentially to pull many other countries from the rest of the world. Doesn't matter if they're democracy or autocracies. Countries like Brazil, like India, like Saudi Arabia, that don't want to be involved in a new Cold War, to bring them over and have them become part of a sort of a not dominated by America economic community. And this is the BRICS community, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, which is going to be enlarged in January of 2024. So I think what the Chinese have clicked is that they need to support the narrative that Russia is offering, that we've been cornered. We're having to react to NATO enlargement, because then they can say the same thing. Look at us here in Asia. We're also being cornered by America, which is building all its alliances up around us to try and constrain us. And by lifting that narrative, what they say to the rest of the world is, trading with China, with Russia is fine. Don't worry about sanctions. And there's only 39 countries imposing sanctions right now. So in a way, what China has played a very important role for Russia. It's created this sort of lifeline, a global economic lifeline, where it does not need to depend, as it did before, on Europe or the United States. It can look south, it can look east. And you've got a much closer, I agree it's of convenience, but a much closer alignment, as people say, between Russia and China than you had before. And that's a very, very interesting development. And, you know, is having its knock-on effects to America and Europe, which we can talk about later.
Jim, I would.
Yeah. Well, we agree on the fact that China had no interest in turning global conditions into this feud kind of situation in which we are. And for the reason you mentioned, this is a very dynamic economy which is integrated in the global economy very much so. The interdependence actually between the United States and China is very high, and instead of decreasing despite everything, it keeps increasing actually. So these are countries which are almost it's part of their fate to work together in some way, and that's why the Chinese were very much shocked by the sudden turn in language between the Obama administration and Donald Trump. Now, you can tell me as much as you want about the fact that this is a matter of democracy versus authoritarianism. I can't believe that Donald Trump is the best embodiment of democracy. Right? I have some...
We're not going to disagree with
controversial.
That.
Controversial.
I have some difficulty believing in that. So you see that this is not a matter of defending democracy. When Donald Trump is so much anti-Chinese, this is the most anti-Chinese administration in U.S.
His family has quite a bit of business in China, as you know, so I don't know how anti-Chinese he really is.
Now, that leads very well to a question. So we've got some... I think we've got... 17 minutes or so. So the first question...
Let me, please, make my last point. China was not informed. Everything shows now. We know, the more we know that Putin decided at the very last minute to invade Ukraine. He kept it... 2 days into the invasion, China made an official statement explaining that China stands for the territorial integrity of all countries, including Ukraine. This was completely shunned by the United States. Joe Biden was more interested in AUKUS, in Quad, in Indian, in bringing India into some kind of alliance against China, rather than bringing or offering to the Chinese, let us collaborate to stop this war, and, well, you say the UN Charter, let us go for the UN Charter. And that's what the Chinese keep saying. But who is the country, I mean, which country is the one that has most often violated the UN Charter? I mean, you can't ignore the fact that this is the United States. And a few years into the New World Order, not only 1999, you had the Kosovo War, the first war, which circumvented the UN Security Council and therefore violated international law. But much more seriously, a few years later, you had the invasion of Iraq, about which this country, in this country we know a lot,
yep.
Which was a total disaster. and which was in total violation of international law and the UN Charter. And if we don't take all that into the picture, then we can't, we won't be objective in dealing with it.
I agree with this point.
This point, so we've got about 16 minutes left, we've got the questions piling up. So we've got a big audience and everyone seems to ask a question, so we can go through a few of these. So let's have some brief answers, a couple of sentences from both of you to answers to each question. So how do you see the results of the upcoming US presidential elections, or US speaker and US presidential elections, impacting Russia, China foreign policy? You've got two sentences. You've got two sentences. One for the speaker, one for the president.
It depends who wins. So, if you're going to get Donald Trump, or I'd say even a Ron DeSantis on the Republican side, the relationship. Well, to be honest, I think if Donald Trump were to win, obviously all bets. It's all very complicated. But he is a pragmatist about foreign policy. He cares about Donald Trump. That's all he cares about. So I'd be very worried about America. I'd therefore be worried about America's allies under Donald Trump. But I think he's not looking for fights. He's not picking fights. But if Donald Trump doesn't win, and it's a Ron DeSantis, a Republican wins that isn't, in other words, he doesn't stand, if that were to happen, they are going to be much tougher on China. They will use China as the enemy, and we could get in a bad place. If Biden wins, then I think it's okay. Because what the Biden administration is trying to do, despite, I think, what you said, Gilbert, is pull back from hyper interdependence with China, but they're not trying to cut off the relationship. So I'd be Biden fine, Trump probably okay, another Republican, bad news.
Okay, those were
on China.
Those were two very long sentences with lots of semicolons in them.
Okay,
that's a tough question.
Gilbert?
Well, I think if it's if Donald Trump wins, I don't see anyone else on the Republican side winning. I mean, Ron DeSantis.
If he's allowed to run,
it has been. But well. Donald Trump would don't refer. I mean, we shouldn't forget this is a man who boasts about being an expert in the art of the deal, isn't it?
Somebody wrote that book for him.
The title of his book. So he will try to organize a deal with Vladimir Putin and Europeans about Ukraine, but it won't please the Ukrainians because he won't support back them on everything they want. So he will try to impose some kind of compromise. Yeah. That's what would happen if Biden wins, or the Democrats. This would be a continuation of what we have. And yes, about China, I think the Biden administration is just lacks any vision. You know, they started continuating Donald Trump completely, and now they are trying to shift again, and trying to mend fences to a certain degree. So they are inconsistent. This is a completely inconsistent administration when it comes to China.
Okay, we've got another 800 questions to go, and not much time to do them. The inevitable one, which we were expecting, who will Russia and China most likely side with in the current Middle East conflict? So Gilbert, you start this time.
China has adopted a neutral profile when it comes to the Middle East. It doesn't involve into any of the conflicts. It keeps good relations with everyone. It's building a port in Haifa in Israel, and it has very close relations with the Saudi Kingdom, which is a main purveyor of oil to China. Russia too has actually, relations with both sides. Russia has close relations with Israel, by the way, and that's one reason why the Israelis did not support Ukraine, and the war has been very, very, very mute on this, because they coordinate with the Russians, even in Syria. Periodically you have Israeli strikes on Iranian concentrations in Syria. These are coordinated with the Russians, because Russians have plenty of anti-air missiles in Syria, but they don't shoot at Israeli planes.
Robin, what do you think?
They will both side against the United States.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the way, you know, so they're best hang back, hope that the Israeli Netanyahu and now coalition government overplays its hand. So then the Americans will still attack Israel, because it's both their commitment to the country, but also because of elections that are coming up. And then hope that America's credibility is further undermined, and try to say as little as possible while they do it.
Okay.
They should hire Robin as an advisor.
Yeah, exactly.
I think so.
I don't think they need me. I think they worked that one out for themselves.
Interesting question. What will happen when Putin and or Xi are no longer leading their respective countries?
So I've got to look at 2040, have I?
Depends if they succeed in embalming Putin or not, doesn't it?
I mean, I'm just thinking, we don't know how long Xi Jinping, obviously we don't know how long both either will last, but it's interesting that there should be an election, well, there will be an election in Russia in March 24, at which Putin, having shifted the constitution recently, can technically stand, because it's new, for another 2 6-year periods. So he could run, you know all this, he could run to 2036. But let's take the question at face value. Who would succeed them?
What will happen
when
they are no longer leading their respective countries? So in a sense, if Russia and China are no longer led by Putin or Xi, how will that change?
So just one quick comment, very quick comment, then. I think what would change in Russia is that we would do a deal with whoever leads Russia that isn't Putin of Ukraine. Because it's really personalized around him. Yep. Rightly or wrongly, it's personalized. That's it. When Xi has gone, we're on the same track. We're going to separate, but hopefully not end up fighting each other. There's no change.
I agree with that. Xi Jinping is a man of the system. He epitomizes the system now, but he's a man of the system. He's a product of the system. Putin is an autocrat in the full sense of the term. He's a new tsar. It's a kind of new version of tsarism that you have in Russia. That's why the post-Putin is much more of a question mark than the post-Xi Jinping. Mm. And, of course, it will depend, among other things, of what happened with this Ukraine war.
Mm. As long as Xi Jinping doesn't stay in power so long that he goes Putin.
Okay, another interesting one. Most of these are from Anonymous, so thank you, Anonymous. You've been writing a lot. Is China prepared to take the heat if it invades Taiwan, or is there a price they're willing to accept in return for not doing so?
I'll start. If China were to invade Taiwan or even carry out a blockade, it would be only and only because it felt, say it, the Communist Party of China felt that it had absolutely no choice. I think it's the last thing they want to do. So if they did it, it would be because Taiwan had declared independence or the US was selling the Taiwanese such sophisticated weaponry that they felt they were losing the window to be able to at least feel that they had a military security in that part of the region to do what they wanted to do. So if they did it, it would be because it was an extreme situation. And if it's an extreme situation, nothing will block China from doing it. Nothing. Because in the end, if there's a chance that the Communist Party of China would oversee the loss of Taiwan, the Communist Party of China will not survive. So, you know, we'd have to be an extreme scenario, but in that extreme scenario, nothing would hold them back. Not sanctions, not nothing.
Chibet?
No, I completely agree with that, and that's why I think that poking this fire by the United States all the time, like Nancy Pelosi's visit, among other things, are
wasn't clever
provocations, which are, dangerous for both the Taiwanese and the whole global situation because of everything that we said.
Well, it's no good if you're both agreeing, is it?
China benefited from policy position.
I'm desperately scrolling through the questions to find a more divisive one, but I can't find one. I've got an interesting
one. We've been divided enough. Let us come together a bit at the end, please.
I thought this whole theme was Cold War, isn't it?
Yes.
What role do you feel competition for rare earth metals will play in the new Cold War, or maybe is already playing in the new Cold War? Is that a bit technical?
I think it's huge. I mean, it's the new... You could say the way that oil was sort of competed over in the last Cold War, certainly in the Middle East, obviously, is sort of the dynamic here. The problem is the rare earths are not as rare as we think they are. They tend to be everywhere. The problem is that only certain countries have mastered the processes at an environmental and financial cost they can do, which is principally China. But I actually think that the competition for minerals is something that could be good for the future, because it means we in Europe in particular are going to have to start looking at Africa a lot more seriously. If we in Europe, and I mean all of Europe, Britain, EU, the whole lot, want to have a secure future, Africa has to be successful. I mean, Africa, all the countries there. It's a huge generalization, I appreciate. But they have access to a lot of these minerals and materials. China's in there ahead of us. There is a move and a push going on right now, started with the last G20 summit. Some big announcements, you can look them up. America, Saudi Arabia, India, Europe are all collaborating, trying to get in on that act. So actually, I think, although there's competition over it, in the end, it's a chance for us to engage better with Africa. I want to say something optimistic.
That's interesting, because the little machine I have here ranks the questions by the number of people who are interested or support having it asked, and that leads actually to the most popular question, which is how important is the African continent as a key battleground for great power competition, Gilbert? Not just over rare earth metals, but generally.
Well, essentially for rare metals and such issues. I mean, the Middle East has been important because of oil. As Chomsky put it once, had Kuwait been exporting dates, you would never have had the United States sending 500,000 soldiers to liberate Kuwait, right? So, of course, I mean, that's how it works. Now, that's a good comparison between the oil and the era and those rare metals, because China has a lot of those rare metals,
exactly,
whereas the United States had a lot of oil. It was a major, and still is a major, yep, oil producer.
Very good point.
You have a lot of shale oil. So here that would change the yep, conditions globally.
While you're looking, they're also competing for votes. I just want to get that in quickly so we don't waste a second. The Chinese are buying votes as well. I mean, part of their investment is to buy votes at the UN. This whole shift of trying to change who leads the world, if I can put it that way. Africa's important not just because of resources for China, but also because of votes and voting power in the UN General Assembly and so on as well. So, you know, this the South Pacific as well. It's interesting. Right. Next question. You ready for it?
I would say we have only 4 minutes left, unfortunately. So I think we could maybe go to the final question, which is my favorite one, I think, is you can start with this, Robin. Are we all going to hell in a handcart?
So when I stepped down as the director of Chatham House last summer, so in July of last year, I had to give a farewell lecture, you know? And so I thought, well, I better try and say something. And the first thing that I said was that I didn't imagine that having taken over in 2007, I'd be stepping down 2022 with the world having gone from a relative world of optimism around globalization to a world in which geopolitics had so reasserted their, I'd even say, dominant position. And we've talked a lot about what we've talked about today, so I don't handy rehearse that. I finished up by saying, I am an optimist, sorry, as Gramsci would have said, I am a pessimist of the intellect, but an optimist of the will. And I would say on an optimistic side, I think one thing that Putin has done for liberal democracies is brought us together at a time when we were collapsing and falling apart. And as somebody who believes in liberal democracy, I'm quite happy to see Britain and the EU and the G7 and Australia and Japan and South Korea and Australia coming together and doing things together in ways they were not doing before. Because I think we're heading into very dangerous times, including with unpredictable American leadership, and we need to have that community be strong for the future. And ironically, this coming together of Russia and China is making that group have a common sense of purpose. And I think even if Trump comes in, it'd be gone after 4 years. I think it'll survive that time. So, and I think we're focusing on Africa a lot more, and that is hugely important. I've used up 2 minutes. I'm stopping.
Okay, and Gilbert, 2 minutes of optimism to finish us off.
Right. Well, I think Robin is very much still in the old Cold War mind frame. Why so? Because speaking of all the countries he mentioned as the beacon of democracy, at the time when you have the far right representing one half at least of the voters in the United States of America and the full Republican dominating the Republican Party, when you have a rise of the far right in Europe, You have a heir of Mussolini in government in Italy. You have Viktor Orban in Hungary. We will see what will happen tomorrow in the election in Poland if the hard right will carry on. And you may very well have Marine Le Pen in France in 27. Mm. So this idea that the West represents democracy versus authoritarianism is something that might be very well completely outdated in some times, if the worst carries on. And that's, we can't get to the question.
We want a bit of optimism.
I tried.
he quoted Gramsci to please me.
Yeah, exactly. I tried.
So I can't disagree with that. I think, and everything that I've been saying is because I believe that another world is possible. Yeah. And that's why I think that another world was possible. Because I don't think there is anything like fatality and, fate in history. You have human-made decisions, and they are very important in shaping the world in which we are. And that's why, I mean, I can't be optimistic. There is really no reason for optimism.
Oh.
Really, no reason for optimism. Just look at the environment. Just look at climate change.
Gaza.
But there is still hope.
Ah.
And there is a big difference. Optimism is the belief that the best will happen.
Yeah.
Hope is the belief that there is a potential for something else which would be better. And that's what we should have. Hope and work on it. Thank you.
That is perfect way to end.
We agree on that.
So continuing that theme, I hope you all go to the bookshop across the road and across the pathway here, snap up a copy of Gilbert Achcar's The New Cold War. I hope a few months from now you all snap up a copy of Robin Niblett's as yet unnamed book, but watch out for it.
It'll be out much.
And I hope you enjoy what remains of the festival. Thank you very much indeed for coming here and being asked of it.